From KCRW Santa Monica and KCRW.com, this is Left, Right, and Center.
You like potato?
And you like potato?
You like tomato?
And you like tomato?
Potato?
Potato?
Tomato?
Tomato?
Let's call a thing
Wall Street versus Main Street. Healthcare marches on, new troubles in Afghani Pakistan, plus what's the deal with Balloon Boy? Hello again and welcome to Left, Right, and Center, your civilized yet provocative antidote to the screaming talking heads that dominate political debate. I'm Matt Miller, columnist for the Daily Beast and senior fellow at the Center for American Progress, speaking for the Political Center while moderating our provocative crew here on Left, Right, and Center. Joining me on the left side of the political spectrum, back in the liberal haunts of San Francisco today, is Robert Scheer, editor-in-chief of TruthDig.com. On the right from Washington, as always, is Tony Blankley, editorial columnist for the Washington Times. Sorry, an old cassette was in my head, Tony. And visiting senior fellow at the Heritage Foundation. And with me here in the Santa Monica mothership from the independent progressive blogosphere is our own Arianna Huffington, editor-in-chief of the Huffington Post. A big news this week on the economic front. I do want to call out Robert Scheer, however, because there was a wonderful review in the New York Times last weekend with a picture of Bob in 1966, I think, when he was running for Congress. The book was about the history of Ramparts magazine, which Bob so boldly led in its heyday. And it was great to see that kind of tribute in the Times, in the book, et cetera. So kudos to you, Bob. And we should put a link on our site to all of that. Do you want to take a bow, Bob? An audio bow? it was great. It was great to see. So on the economy this week, the disconnect being observed by so many, lots of folks cheering on Wall Street as the Dow crossed 10,000 on Friday. As we went to air, it was still bobbing a little bit below that, but it's up something like, you know, nearly 50% since the low of 6,500 back in March. Lots of cheers about this, including not just from the fat cats, but anyone who's got a 401k is probably in a happier mood with their investments having gone up than they were before. But contrasting that with near 10% unemployment, likely to go beyond 15 million Americans unemployed. Goldman Sachs reporting earnings and likely bonuses that are on the scale of the heyday of 2007 before the meltdown. Why don't we start with you, Ramparts, former Ramparts editor Robert Scheer. What would you have made of this then? How come capitalism still produces these anomalies?
The enemy was not capitalism. The enemy were people who are rigging the system and denying the free market, which is really how this whole thing happened, and getting government to work for them, putting through legislation which allowed them to fleece the rest of us. The news as we go to, even for Wall Street, was not good on Friday because B of A reports very big losses, over $2 billion this quarter, and they predict their losses in the future. Because they're much more massively exposed to this stuff. And the U.S. government, of course, has bailed out B of A with substantial funds, and they're in trouble. A number of other banks are in trouble. There are foreclosures. So even if one thinks of the health of Wall Street, it's by no means smooth sailing. But it's a bad barometer to take Wall Street because it affects, you know, somewhat 8% of the population. And the rest of the population is affected by things that Wall Street chooses to ignore, which is the foreclosures, the amount of unemployment, and so forth. And the reason B of A is in trouble is they're holding a lot of those mortgages, and they're going south. And now commercial mortgages are starting to unravel in very big ways, and particularly in major American cities where redevelopment and everything else was connected with them. We see that in Los Angeles, where some of our biggest developers have gone belly up, and big condo developments and office building developments have gone belly up. So even for Wall Street, we're not out of the woods. But in terms of the ordinary Americans, the suffering is very deep. And the only thing to crow about is, well, maybe we have so far avoided the Great Depression. The bad news also is that we are not moving in any serious way to get the kind of regulation through Congress that would prevent this from happening again. And that is a really bad mark. And as the New York Times pointed out in a very strong editorial, the kind we would have been proud to have in Ramparts this week, they said that, in fact, the banking lobbyists are controlling Congress and we're not getting meaningful regulation.
Tony, how do you see the Main Street-Wall Street divide, if at all?
Well, a rising Dow is almost invariably going to precede a general expansion of the economy. But every rising Dow does not presage an expanding economy. So in other words, it rises and falls more often than it rises, and then the economy always follows. So the question is this simply a sort of a technical rally? There's a lot of money to be spent. There's a lot of liquidity, and institutional investors have got to make their marks. So the market's going up, but the underlying economy is questionable, and the big, I think, danger is the huge deficit, the ever-growing debt, the weakening dollar, which if we ever have to support the dollar, if it drops another 10%, it's already dropped 10% in value in the last few months, would have to be done by the Fed raising interest rates, which would crush our incipient economic recovery. So I think there's a lot of big question marks on the horizon, and I would not take the rising Dow, which is good news always, as an indicator necessarily that the economy is going to be coming along.
What do you make of it, Arianna? I would toss in, too, just per Bob's point, Citigroup, which has got about $45 billion of U.S. taxpayers' money reported another loss, 7 out of 8 quarters. And Vikram Pandit, their CEO, said the U.S. consumer credit remains the number one issue affecting our near-term results. They've suffered credit losses of $8 billion in the last 3 months in the consumer business, meaning average folks are maxed out and defaulting, you know, on their debt, sort of a stark reminder of this the sort of different fates at the top and the bottom right now.
Absolutely. And we still haven't dealt with their toxic assets. Remember, there are toxic assets that we're supposed to deal with. They're still there. We still haven't dealt with the impending collapse of many commercial real estate properties. And beyond that, though, is the question of what these enterprises have become. They are now what Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac used to be called, government-sponsored enterprises. So the fact that they're making all these profits that Goldman Sachs and J.P. Morgan announced this week has a lot to do, indeed it has everything to do with the fact that they have been taxpayer-subsidized. And that's the anomaly, and that's where the anger is coming from, the fact that the connection between what's happening in Wall Street and what's happening on Main Street is completely tenuous. Originally, we were supposed to bail out these companies in order to provide credit to small businesses and families. That has not happened, and that's a massive failure.
A couple of thoughts just to toss in. One is, one thing that never gets talked about that folks I talk to say is sort of one of the quiet aspects of this is instead of the big toxic relief fund, which sort of died stillborn. I don't think it's been used at all. Or maybe there's a one bank that's thinking about trying to do it. But there's been this sort of quiet muddle through strategy to recapitalize the banks. But remember, interest rates that the banks can get their source of funds at are, you know, near 0% from the Fed and the ability to access that money. And the, you know, even if they're loaning out at 4%, 5%, 6%, their cost of funds now is so low. Even CDs are paying 1.5-2%. The spread that they're getting because of this difference of the, you know, how they're doing is this sort of this quiet way for them to make a chunk of change over the next couple of years and quietly muddle through and recapitalize themselves. Interesting. But the thing, and you touched on this, that I think never gets enough attention is at all the banks and at the Goldmans of the world, the net worth of thousands of senior executives. I've only seen William Cohan write on this, the guy who wrote the Big Bear Stearns book. The net worth of thousands of senior executives at Wall Street has been totally bolstered by the massive government intervention across the board, and yet they're the folks who are still resisting the kind of regulatory reform that we need, and there's no question their personal net worths would have been largely eviscerated had government not mounted this unprecedented, you know, since the Depression effort to stabilize markets that had become chaotic. Tony, I know this has got – oh, I got to go back to Bob. Sorry, I got to keep passing the mic around. In true Ramparts tradition, this is an outrage that is 60s worthy, isn't it, Bob?
Well, first of all, you keep bringing up Ramparts as if life has stopped. Truth Dig, which I edit, is Ramparts on speed. We've had 40 million people come to it. I think Arianna would make similar claims for Huffington Post. So life does go on in the world of independent journalism.
Forgive me.
Okay, but let me say, I take your point about Wall Street. It's not only that they are acting as if everything is wonderful after we bailed them out, but the news this week was that they are giving $143 billion in pay, $143 billion extra pay, and this is a record. They are rewarding themselves at an all-time high in their entire history. They have never had higher pay for the top financial firms. So they're not only saying, hey, we're out of the woods, but we deserve the biggest pay ever. If you take the case of Goldman Sachs, a company that was mysteriously allowed to change its whole status and become a bank, be qualified for TARP funds and so forth, and they make this enormous amount of money. And what there was very interesting testimony this week by the Inspector General of the Treasury Department and Elizabeth Warren from the COPS, from the Congressional Oversight Panel, all saying we still do not have transparency. We still do not know where the Fed put its money. We still do not have any accountability. And so we look at it at really congressional people are looking at it as outsiders. And then again, this other story this week with Geithner's phone calls were revealed in a Wall Street Journal, marvelous Wall Street Journal story, where they point out he spends most of his time talking to the top bankers, far more than even the congressional leaders that he's supposed to be negotiating with.
Ariana's raising her hand, and then Tony.
I have my hand up.
Well, Tony does have a verbal hand up. But I do share Tony's concern about the debt and deficits, by the way. I just think that Obama's going to start that discussion in January once health care is done.
Let me just go back on.
Okay. Go ahead, Tony.
I was going to say, I'll put the social justice issues aside and go back to what Ariana said about the commercial real estate, because this is the great dog that hasn't barked yet. A lot of commercial real estate was rescheduled in 2005, 6, and 7 on five-year notes, which means they're going to come due on 10, 11, and 12. But the property is essentially below, the value is below their mortgage, so that we're going to have a tremendous pressure on banks, both national and community, coming up starting next year, and they better have a lot more cash on hand, or they're going to be pressured at least as badly as the banks were on the private side this time.
And this is not about social justice. God knows social justice is important. But this is about saving capitalism. And this is not a sustainable model. This is not going to work, which is why you see the Wall Street Journal and the Financial Times and the Economist and many instruments of wanting to chronicle and save capitalism coming to the attack of Geithner and Summers and what this administration is doing. It is absolutely stunning. And on top of it, the final purely tactical thing that they're ignoring is what's going to happen in 2010, with unemployment by then in double-digit numbers, which is inevitable the way we're going, and foreclosure skyrocketing. How is this congressional Democratic majority going to go back to the people and saying, re-elect me?
Well, but the one thing I'd say is you can't pass the final verdict until we see where the dust clears on financial regulatory reform. And, you know, I realize there are, you know, problems afoot and there are things that are being weakened. But if we emerge with stronger capital requirements and the inability of, of these major institutions to just enrich themselves while promoting incredible systemic risk that tanks the economy, then we will have done something. I think it's too soon to tell, but it's right for us to keep the pedal to the metal on reform.
Can I say one quick thing on capital requirements?
Yes.
By increasing capital requirements, which I agree we need in the out years, it makes for a contractive force on the economy currently. So they've got to be very careful how they, you know, if you require the banks to hold more money now when we need to have that money loaned out, then we're not going to have the expansion we need. On the other hand, if we require them to let them keep loan out now with a lower reserve, then they won't have the reserves they need when the commercial loans go bust in
but
a couple of years.
I agree with you, but that's precisely, Tony, why we need these massive, epic, troubling, but for the near term, deficits to muscle us through while we do all these things simultaneously.
We need to debate that point more broadly.
We will do that, but we won't do it just now. Up ahead, healthcare gets real, plus the deeper meaning of Balloon Boy. You're listening to Left, Right, and Center.
Find more Left, Right, and Center programs and podcasts at kcrw.com.
Back again with Left, Right, and Center. I'm Matt Miller in the center. Robert Scheer is in San Francisco on the left. Tony Blankley in Washington on the right. Ariana Huffington with me here in Santa Monica and from the independent progressive blogosphere. Don't forget to let us know what you think about this whole Wall Street versus Main Street divide in the economy at our blog at kcrw.com/LRC. Healthcare. We need to. Did you have a nanosecond you wanted to add on whatever that last thought was, Ariana?
Well, just a nanosecond that what Tony said is
time.
I let him speak before, remember? And now that's what I'm getting back. Don't worry. When we are
have several nanoseconds. Go ahead.
When we are in person.
What a literalist.
When we are in person together next Sunday, let's give a plug to our event, come on, Matt, right?
Oh, yes, that's right. We will be.
I'm going to take revenge. Just, I promise that. But my nanosecond is that commercial real estate and the fact that we're still dealing with a too-big-to-fail problem and the toxic assets have not been dealt with is not just a big dog that has not barked, but the kind of problem that can once again bring us back to what we thought we're beyond forever, another sort of imminent collapse.
On that happy thought.
I don't disagree with you, Arianna.
I was confirming the fact that it's beyond right and left.
Well, on that unified, depressing thought, you want to talk about healthcare, where there was positive news this week, at least if you want major healthcare reform, as some of us do. The baucus bill passed out of committee with the vote of Olympia Snow, who's now the sort of the single most important senator in America, and most powerful one. Bob Scheer, what do you make of it now? The work is underway. The White House is at the table as the Senate works to reconcile the two different bills in the Senate. There's the ones in the House. This is all sort of moving now toward the, you know, if it's not the end of the beginning or the beginning of the end, we're somewhere closer to the end of this process. But still a lot that has to be ironed out. Critics mentioning, I among them, who want something to happen, that the lack of enough subsidies now to make the health insurance truly affordable remains a serious issue, and if we don't do that, we could end up backfiring by trying to mandate people to get coverage that that cost them too much of their income. But what do you make of where we stand after this week, Bob?
Well, I agree with your last sentiment. And by the way, I'm trying to respond to the people on our blog site who say I should be more cheerful and happy. So let me say, it's very difficult with this proposal. When I first read it, I wanted to cheer it on, something, anything. I am now of a different mind. I think the wrong proposal could set us back. The proposal that came out, I think it was too high a price to pay for that one Republican vote, if that's what caused it. But you set it up with for those who favor major health care reform. Well, I do favor major health care reform, but I don't favor delivering people, forcing people to get insurance, whether they like it or not, penalizing them if they don't get insurance, and leaving them to the tender mercies of the insurance companies. And as I read this, you know, and particularly what I worry about is whatever you think of the current proposal, when they try melding it with the other proposals, it's going to be Olympia Snow, who by the way, she said she may not even vote for the final thing, so she's holding out a real threat here on what's going to emerge. She said, this is my vote today. It's not necessarily my vote on the bill. And so it seems to me that the Democrats are squandering the gift that the voters and the trust that the voters put into them. The voters said, we want you guys to take your turn, you know, at the plate. It's your turn. And instead of swinging, they're bunting. Instead of going for the bleachers, they're bunting. And it's awful. And let me just make one point about this. The expense, which the Republicans make so much of, $85 billion a year, and they call that socialized medicine. They call it government control. But you give an amount 20 times greater to Wall Street, and that, what is that? That's not socialism. That's not wasteful. That, you know, the hypocrisy in this debate. But my basic view is, if you don't have serious cost control, and you will not get that without a vigorous public option of some kind, it's not a reform.
Let me say, Tony, I want to get you in a sec, but let me say, offering another Democratic point of view, Bob, well, I think, while well-intended, I think you're not reading what's happening properly. I think, first, remember, we already have the smallest plans on the table are now 800 and something billion over 10 years. 8 months ago or a year ago, if you had said that would have been considered the conservative option, it would have been considered a historic progressive achievement. I agree with you. The subsidies need to go up because we have to be able to make sure that this stuff is affordable. But when you start with that as being where what comes out of the conservative side of the Senate, I think there's room for this thing to move. What you can see the tea leaves lining up for is a public option trigger, I think, that will be part of what this end game is, where you have, if there is not certain affordability metrics met in at the state level, if it doesn't, if people can't buy a decent policy for X percent of their income if they're low income, or X percent of their income, which will be greater if they're higher income, there will be a public option triggered. And that, I think, that approach will be able to politically thread thread the needle between the conservative Democrats and even a handful of Republicans who don't want to see that. But you can't argue against, if there's not affordable options, how the public can't come into play. And the more and the folks who are more liberal, who know that this will happen if we haven't met the affordability metrics that, after all, is what health care reform is about. So I think it's, if we get bigger subsidies, because you need that to be able to make this stuff affordable, I think we're moving towards something that could be very powerful, Tony. My guess is you don't agree.
Well, we do have an alternative, which is not to create a new entitlement. But since that's not on the table, at least currently, here's the problem that the Democrats have, and the Republican that agrees with them, is that if you have the mandate, which you need to create the universe of payers so that there's enough healthy people in the system to pay for the sick people, then it costs too much. Therefore, they're giving subsidies to the mandate. But if you give subsidies to the mandate to make it more just for the middle class and lower middle class who can't afford to pay the premiums, then you increase the deficit, which the president has correctly says he doesn't want to increase by a penny. So the problem is it's a three-way push, and each time you push one, the other two go in the wrong direction, and they can't fix that. It's either going to increase the deficit, it's not going to be enough healthy people in the pool, or you're going to force relatively poor people to pay more than they can afford.
But
as a result, you are right, and the result will be a public sector system rather than a private sector system, and that will be a socialized medical system in 5 or 10 years.
No, because the other answer, which you're not, is that you pay for the increase in subsidies, and in the end game, you find a way to pay for it or come close enough for government work that you're committing to, you're actually going to pay for the government that you want.
You don't pay for it. It'll be the Chinese who will loan us the money because we don't have it. So we'll be borrowing money from China to pay for the health care for Americans. That's the formula, and it won't last for long because the Chinese are a merciless people.
No, you cut spending and you raise taxes and you pay for the government you want. Used to be a conservative idea. Ariana.
Can we hear from Ariana? Yeah.
The problem right now is that the key pillars for real health care reform are not being constructed. We're not going to have real cost containment without a public option as opposed to a fake public option trigger. We are not dealing with prevention, and without prevention, without real prevention, there's going to be an incredible increase in healthcare costs, no matter what the CBO says. And the final thing is the fact that we are actually putting our trust in the healthcare industry, and the stories that have emerged this week about how the healthcare industry has operated and how they have exempted women, the pre-existing conditions that are mounting, I don't understand why we can trust them.
Right.
Let me suggest something for a second. I agree with you. It's unfortunate that we want to trust the insurance people. It's also unfortunate that we're in a position where we have to trust the government. Perhaps we should be free people and trust ourselves. How about that as an alternative?
Okay. Right, but that's a false choice. It's not some virginal threshold choice between government and markets.
Time to be a virgin again, Doris Day.
Healthcare, go ahead, Bob. We want to get to Afghanistan then, too.
If Tony is really serious about that position, and it's the position of the Republican Party,
I'm not saying you are, but I don't think you're such a fringe figure.
But if that is in fact the real position of conservatives, okay, however you categorize
just
yourself,
myself,
and so you're willing to give up, first of all, the military health care program we have for you're willing
no,
to give
I
up
didn't say
a
that.
Better. Well, when you say people should take care of themselves, the fact is,
people who serve in the military enter a contract in which they get the health care exchange.
Let's not all talk at once. What about people who are over 65? Let Bob
finish.
We
obviously have moved from this Hobbesian conservatism to some sort of social contract, and we recognize that there are social costs for all of us by people just getting ill and not having the preventive medicine that Ariana was talking about, not having timely checkups. We hurt the labor force by people getting ill. We have to take care of people, whether they're treated in the emergency room or not. So we recognize that a sound health system is necessary for the economy. It's necessary for our corporations, our industry to be competitive overseas and so forth. That's all been accepted. So this idea that we're going to cut off debate and call anything that doesn't smack of this Hobbesian world as socialism.
You missed my point.
Tony, just because we're going to run out of time, let me just make my own point.
Do it briefly, Bob, just because we've got no time left.
All right. I just want to say, first of all, for Tony or anyone to say that $85 billion a year, which is the what we're talking about, that they're talking about, is socialized medicine and socialism and so forth, and yet blithely accept this enormous government intrusion into Wall Street is hypocritical. How do you spend, first of all, in the first throw, $700 billion and really much trillions up the road and not consider that socialism? What you want is socialism for the rich and not for the rest of us.
Brief rebuttal, Tony, then we're going to have to...
My only point is that when you give up rugged individualism, you have to accept the condition of trusting untrustworthy entities like governments and insurance companies. That's my only point. Don't complain about trusting untrustworthy organizations when you give up trusting yourself only.
Any thoughts on this, Ariana? We're going to have to, by the way, punt on Afghanistan and Pakistan until next week because of the sheer passion around healthcare. But we've got about 20 seconds before we rant. Any last thoughts
on that? Well, the idea of trusting ourselves only goes against some key sort of elements of American life, including Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid. So I don't know what kind of world Tony is dreaming of.
We have reached that time once again for our famed end of show, Left, Right, and Center Rant, featuring pet peeves from across the ideological spectrum. Make sure to share your own rants at our blog at kcrw.com/LRC. Tell us what you think of the latest developments in healthcare and this whole balance between government and the free market. Ariana Huffington, about 20 seconds each today. It's your rant. Feel free to talk about Balloon Boy, which we did promise.
I'm going to talk about Balloon Boy because yesterday I went on the Ed Show to talk about Afghanistan and my provocative column that Joe Biden should resign if he disagrees with escalating. And it was all about Balloon Boy. So Ed comes to me and says, so what do you think about the Balloon Boy? And I say, you know what, Ed? Once the Balloon Boy was found, can you please explain to me why we're still talking about it? This is a non-story. It's pure voyeurism. I'm sick of it.
Tony Blankley.
Yeah.
What do you think about Balloon Boy, Tony? Just kidding.
I don't care about Balloon Boy. I'm dreaming of, to answer Ariana's question, I'm dreaming of Jeffersonian democracy, but I can't figure out how to get back to 1805.
Robert Scheer.
I hope that Jeffersonian democracy doesn't include slavery, or that would be too conservative. But let me say a point about Afghanistan. We're contemplating an escalation in that country that will dwarf the cost of health care, okay? Because if you escalate in Afghanistan, you're going to spend a lot more than $85 billion a year, and you'll be there for another 10 years. So why don't you think about it? Escalating Afghanistan or guaranteeing health care for Americans? That's the choice.
Well, I want to urge people to, on all sides of the debate, to be open to this idea of a public option trigger as the as sort of the key forcing device we're going to need if we're going to get healthcare costs under control in the long term. Because if we put in a mechanism that says, look, we're going to roll out this plan with the exchanges and the people having access to competing private plans, but say that if affordability metrics are not met, if people can't buy what is considered a decent healthcare plan, and that'll get defined in the legislation, at X percent of their income, if they're at the poverty level, or some higher percent of income for people who are better off, if those metrics are not met, a public option competitor comes into play. That becomes the forcing device, state by state, for the entire health sector to have to get together, not just the insurers, but the local oligopolies among the hospital and doctor groups who today have enormous market power in different markets, and they're the ones who are driving health costs higher depending on their market power. We need a forcing device for that conversation. A public option trigger can be the way. That's all the triggers we've got time for today on Left, Right, and Center. Thanks, as always, to Robert Scheer, Ariana Huffington, and Tony Blankley. Sarah Spitz produced today's program. Our technical director is J.C. Swadek. I'm Matt Miller. Thanks for listening. Tune in again next week for more Left, Right, and Center.
I wear pajamas.
You got pajamas.
But we know we need each other, so we better call the calling of
all. You can podcast Left, Right, and Center, share it with a friend, or embed it on your blog from our new media player at kcrw.com. Send questions or comments to our blog at kcrw.com/LRC. Left, Right, and Center is produced and distributed by KCRW Santa Monica.